Yeah, 25-footer.
Okay, I'm going to call this meeting of the House Interim Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness to order. This will be informational meetings today, and we've got several people here that we've invited to testify, and I appreciate people doing that. And I would remind the committee at the end, we'll talk a little bit about committee bills, but part of some of these ongoing conversations we're having today may not, well, we're probably not yet there for 2016, but it's issues that are ongoing that we're going to learn some more information about and maybe have, if not recommendations, but 2017, maybe some other questions. The Speaker and I talked recently about a couple issues that we've talked about here and about how we might get to a point of making some kind of recommendations to move some of these forward. So that's the intent of some of these meetings today. So we're going to start off with the update on the legislative emergency planning. So this is all up to date, and we just have to nod. Is that correct? Oh, I mean, Kevin, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me today. For the record, my name is Kevin Hayden, Legislative Administrator, and you're absolutely correct. We're all up to date and ready to go.
Okay, there. We're more comfortable all the time.
Simplest brief ever. What I did want to talk about is in more seriousness, is what we've been working on for the past 6 months and where we're going next with our own emergency planning here at the Capitol. For pretty much the last 6 months, we have been working on our emergency action plan, which is our plan for how to keep staff and people in the building safe in the first 15 to 20 minutes as an emergency is occurring. So it's fire, flood, white powder, bomb scares, all those kinds of things, and how we react to it as an organization and how we train our staff to react to that sort of thing. We took our original emergency action plan that we had, we compared it and modeled it off of FEMA best practices. We worked as inclusively as we could with representatives from the state police, from the Office of Emergency Management, Salem Fire Department, Salem Emergency Management, Marion County Emergency Management, and we used their expertise to help write the individual bills in the plan as to how we would respond to issues. As soon as we got those worked up, we have been working with the various legislative service agencies, talking to staff to make sure that they are familiar, at least on the top level, that there are no final questions or concerns before we go live with it. So we've met with the desks, with most of the agencies, with the caucus offices, and then we've also had some meetings with the other statewide elected officials that have a presence in the building, with the governor's staff, the secretary of state, and the treasurers, all to at least get them baseline familiarity with the plan before we publish it and start saying this is exactly how we're going to do things. We started off with a risk analysis, kind of looking at what the risks are here, what the probability of them happening, and then what the impact of those would be. Developed our concept of operations, making sure we had very clear lines of succession for our own incident command structure. And then work through those incident plans, identifying employee responsibilities, responsibilities of our own incident command structure, and how we hand off and communicate with whoever the first responders coming in that are going to take over the actual incident. And then we also looked at how we would handle emergency actions that occurred when we're not fully staffed. As most of you are aware, we've been having more weekend events, about one a month, so we wanted to make sure that we included that in our planning when we're shorter staffed to make sure that they are just as safe and the people visiting the Capitol at those times are just as safe. One of the keys to this are our evacuation procedures and how we account for people who are coming out and account for people who can't make it out of the building so that we can turn over to first responders where we would expect if people we know were in the building that we can't account for now, where we would expect that they might be, where those areas of refuge are within the building, especially in fire. We've had good conversations about, you know, trying to what we can train people to do to make themselves most safe if they can't get out of the building. We also looked at ways to maintain and update this so that it's not a once every 10 or 15 years we dust it off and look at it again. It will be a living, breathing, ongoing document that as every time we train to it, if we see something that is missing, or every time that it's run for real, every time we have a fire alarm that goes off that we didn't necessarily plan for, we will make sure that we follow through and what worked in the plan, what didn't, and what could we be doing better. So really our next steps are to start to make sure that the people who have a responsibility as part of the incident command structure within the organization know what their responsibilities are, you know, who is first in line or second in line to any particular incident to respond or to gather information, and then to make sure that we start to then do training. And when I say training, it's not just get everybody together at the beginning of session in the house and do that one big training where we're mostly listening to the 900 different things that people talk about, but we have a lot of other things on our mind. But it's also working up those opportunities to do smaller individualized training. During the recent Great Oregon Shakeout, the training that we did, we had of 7 or 8 people who are going around to each office and, you know, stopping by and talking about whatever the topic of the day was during that, to try to get, if people have questions, maybe they'll ask if it's just a smaller 5 or 6 people together rather than the 600 people all listening at once. So we want to do a mixture of online training where we can get it, because there is some very good online training for some of these kinds of incidents, personalized training, and then the larger group training, and then we'll start to roll this out on a very regular basis and train to our emergency action plan. And then as soon as we train to it, you just keep looking at it, see what's working, and keep revising as you go along as necessary until you figure you have it down pat. So that of what we are working on is actually the easier part, because our emergency action plan was pretty well written. It was just bringing it up to the modern age. Our next steps are looking at whether you call it business continuity or continuity of operations, kind of the bigger picture. What happens when we don't have access to the building for whatever reason drove us out? And we have to make sure that we are developing a scalable plan that works, whether it's localized, a flood that keeps us away from the Capitol for 3 days, but we can still get to Salem, or it's the big earthquake that we all hear about, and there are no services available in the area. Where do we go from there? So to that end, there is the beginnings of a business continuity plan community of practice that's been developed under the lead of DHS and OEM that we have started to participate in. And it's to try to get all of us here working together, that as we're developing our business continuity plans, that we're not developing stovepipe plans that work great for us, and then we find out that none of our plans work together. So it's really looking at that bigger picture as far as how we get together, because kind of inherent in our business continuity plan is also the continuity of governance plan as to how exactly government is going to respond, where is government going to be if it's a major event, and then how do we plug into that? You know, we can't have ghost sites, or we could. It would just be very expensive to have ghost sites all over the state so that we could respond to anyone. So it's trying to look for, again, what's the most likely, what are we really planning for, you know, the short and long term as to how we get there. So it's kind of a two-pronged approach for us at this point. One is working with the larger state agency-wide group as far as the continuity of governance to make sure that our plan works. But then working with each of the agencies here in the Capitol to find out what it would take for them to operate if they didn't have access to the Capitol. Whether it's pens and paper or computers and the internet, there are challenges no matter which way we go. So we are working on all of those together to start working on that plan. As a separate note, and something that I hadn't mentioned in the briefing that I gave the Senate, one of the things that we did start last year in advance of this was using the legislature's IT governance board. We had gone through a risk appetite survey for business continuity planning for IT and disaster recovery planning. And one of the policy option packages that we had approved for this in the last legislative session was actually to fund and develop our cold site for some of our IT structure. Some of our IT structure is available in the cloud, so you can get to it anywhere. Some of what we have is in a server room, you know, down by Ledge Council. So working on a cold site so that we have a rollover site so that once the legislature can get up and running, we should have access to some of our tools, too, to make things work better. So I know that that was fast, and I covered a lot of things, but that's really, really kind of where we are and where we're going next. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Questions? Yes, Representative Escobar.
I'm curious. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious. If we had a large earthquake off the coast, what would be the time frame that we would have to get people out of this building? How much warning would we have?
I couldn't say with scientific expertise, but the time to hear as far as warning, it would vary depending on the size, location of the earthquake, but it would not be I'm not thinking.
Well, let's say it was in the Cascadia earthquake area.
Again, because I don't have that right in front of me, I don't want to give an answer and then be completely wrong.
Why don't you email everyone the answer?
I can certainly do that.
Because, I mean, it's going to go so fast. It doesn't matter whether it's a little one or a small one. It's going to go so fast. I want to know what our time frame is once it hits off the coast and what it would be here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there are others on other panels in the room today who could probably
That might be able to answer any questions.
It's minutes.
Good. But, I was at a presentation some time ago, and we talked, that was quite a bit presented on that specific thing, parts of Oregon, how long would you have to prepare and do things. And so it's figures we have, but it's a very good
question.
How much
warning we'll have.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. When I first was appointed chair, I met with Senator Boquist. And this was a topic that came up at the time. And at that, I think our first meeting, we couldn't even find a copy of the continuity plan, but we finally did. So there had been a plan put together a long time ago, but a lot of things that Kevin talked about here, the updating and doing it. Because the reality is, even if it's just been 10 years or however long it was, people change, let alone reasons to change the plan. So I commend the work that they've done so far, kind of preparing all this, how you respond and who does what. But some of the key things yet. So after that, we got some key points and things to address. You've mentioned several times the whole idea of the information. How do we get at it? He talked about some of what we have to do there. So there's a lot of things to do. And one of the things we've been doing as a state is encouraging local jurisdictions and people to get ready. And we haven't necessarily done the same job from a continuity standpoint, especially for here. But if you just think about this building and that warning and about the staffs, what the staffs are going to have to do or not do, it's critical that we have that down pretty pat. Anything else? Again, thank you for, you've done a lot of work in a short period of time, so I appreciate
that. Thank you.
Sure. So now we're going to talk about radios and communicating in emergencies. Mr. Stuckey, is that what we're going to talk about?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for being here.
Yes, sir, you're spot on. Chair Lively, members of the committee, I'm Dave Stuckey, Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. With me today is
Andrew Phelps, Director of the Oregon Office of Emergency Management.
So Director Phelps joined us just about the time the last session started, and he was busy getting his arms around emergency management and the rest of the state. And so now this is his opportunity. We're looking forward to him coming down and helping engage with you on some of these things. Amateur radio is a very, very important topic. It's an important topic in terms of, we've had this discussion in communications at this level in this policy committee multiple times, whether or not it's the chicken or the egg, whether or not we need to talk about whether or not we have to have fuel and resources and helicopters to do something, or we need communications in order to direct those assets. And so ultimately, I've always stuck with, as a former Army officer, the need for communications. That's where it all starts. That's where we have to come up with the assessments and being able to communicate what it is that we need and how bad it is. And amateur radio is certainly one of those. It is I'd offer is probably the main tool that we would have in a catastrophic type event. It's been one of the main tools we've had in a number of less than catastrophic events. In 2007, we had some pretty significant windstorms, 14 counties affected. And from that standpoint, amateur radio was just about the only thing that was communicating with some of the coastal jurisdictions. I was the operations officer in the National Guard's Joint Operations Center, and cell phones and our radios weren't working as well at the time. Amateur radio was, ham radios were, and it's a great asset. Right after 2007, some of those lessons learned, Governor Kulongoski at the time wanted to see a package go out, and so he actually made an investment, a state investment that you helped honor and sign as a legislative body, certain ham radio packages that would go out to the state that we still monitor, and Director Phelps still monitors for the purposes of keeping account of that equipment. But in the end, what we have in amateur radios, we have a couple of different components to it. In what we have an ARES component, which is an association that helps provide support. Off the top of my head, I'd say out of the 36 counties, we have 34 of them that are ARES-like counties, where this association, or the American Radio Relay League, provides this service, or this ARES service, in a high level to these county emergency managers in their ECs, or their ECCs or EOCs, whatever that emergency operations center is. And then there's two other counties, one of which is kind of leans races, and then the other that goes towards just kind of a local ham radio non-association type of component. So we have basically, OEM has this construct where they reach out and touch the counties, and it's the county, and this is a home rule state. These counties, Jackson County or whatever, they're going to help decide how they want to manage that process. And so from our standpoint, OEM will sit there and vet and coordinate and communicate with that emergency manager and say, okay, how do you want to see this work? And they'll be able to badge and provide that level of service to the county in order for that ham radio operator to be working inside that county. We leave it to the counties in a lot of regard. On the OEM side, within the ECC and his Emergency Coordination Center, it's a collaborative effort between ARES, ARRL, and then as well as Director Phelps, because it's still his ECC that's doing it.
Sure, go ahead, Representative Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is that something that is called for, asked to be spelled out in the separate county plans?
Typically, county emergency operations plans will have a communications annex as part of their EOP, and oftentimes amateur radio or auxiliary communications are addressed and structured through that emergency operations plan.
Thank you.
Good question, Representative Huffman. So what we do to help reinforce this is we integrate in communications in the exercises. We, OEM, the counties, oftentimes they'll be doing this on their own. Sometimes we'll be doing it as a state network. Sometimes the focus of the exercises is not necessarily communications, but communications is a component to that. And we not only have to communicate lower to higher, state to county, county to city, but we also have to go reach back to FEMA and Region 10 and other places. And he also has that capability in his ECC.
Mr. Chair.
Sure, go ahead.
Several of us were at DPSST last night, and FPI presented the active shooter film that they had done, and part of what they talked about, and I was kind of smiling as I was sitting there, because as a broadcaster for many years, I would always work with the law enforcement in the gorge to build credibility with them as a radio operator, so that FM radio, not ham, but build the credibility so that we would be one of the first phone calls that they would make to help them get information out. And in the film last night, it was funny how law enforcement, oftentimes media is the last phone call that they want to make, and it should be closer to the top. And so, with that in mind, as we work on plans around the state and priorities, assuming that some media might hopefully still be on the air, it's really important to use our our media partners, particularly broadcast, because it's live and you can get a message out instantly, to use them as partners to direct traffic, guide people away from zones you don't want them to be in, and things of that nature. So I like to bring that up every chance I get to remind folks that they're a critical partner, and we in the Gorge were able to help notify people for many years about what was going on. I don't know if it's still going on or not, but it's a key. And they pointed out in the film last night the same thing, that, you know, Mr. Chief of Police, you can't shy away from the TV cameras or the microphones, because you know, these guys can be more help than just in the way. They're not there to just get a story and pad their pockets. They're there really, most of them have a big heart and they want to help.
Yeah, Chair Lively, Representative Huffman, you're spot on. We have tried to engage that too at the national level. There's a lot of different forms of communication. What we're talking about here with the amateur is really kind of an operational to operational, county to city, state to county type of component. But then you also have through IPAWS, and what FEMA is doing is that connectivity to the broadcasters to notify the public, and then we just have the local media engagement also. There's many, many forms of communication to help keep citizens out of the affected jurisdiction or have them shelter in place if they are inside the incident, depending upon what that is. And so it's a broad topic, and so we certainly have tried to figure out how to do every single one of those angles. The reader boards, the electronic reader boards that you see on I-5 right here on 22 and I-5, another means of communicating to the public. You see the local police do that, or the state police have that. Those messagings, very, very important in anything we can do to get that median across or that information across. So from an amateur radio standpoint, what I'd like to do is just kind of flip this over to Director Phelps and kind of help close up with some of the actions that are occurring inside OEM.
Chair Lively, it's always important to practice the way we want to play. I think that's an important aspect of emergency management, and a big component of that is the drills and exercises that we conduct on a quarterly, if not more frequent, basis than that. Integrating all components of emergency response coordination, including the amateur radio component of that, is a critical piece. If we don't take these tools out and ensure that they're as sharp as they need to be on blue sky days, well, then we're going to have problems, certainly, when we have a bad day here in Oregon. So gearing up for the Cascadia Rising exercise in June of 2016, we've been conducting regular exercises to incorporate our amateur radio volunteers and amateur radio programs throughout the state, establishing connectivity with our amateur radio partners that work at the FEMA regional office and in the adjacent states. So on another note as well, but related note, I've challenged a number of my staff and myself to receive our amateur radio licenses, just to emphasize how important this capability is. It's something I want to learn a lot more about and become more active in, and know that I have the capacity to communicate using amateur radio.
So, Chair Lively, members of the committee, there are other methods, and just kind of capture what the civilian side will be focusing a lot on, the amateur radio and that network and what that capability is. Certainly through IPAWS and integrating in with the locals, whether it's through the telephone messaging or through the media and the broadcasters. And then we also certainly have the military, and they have their own set of communications capabilities. And so if we're dealing with the catastrophic, the worst case scenario, and the only thing that's standing out there, all those cell phones towers are down, all the towers that help operate ODOTs and the state police's communication systems, those things are all down. We're still going to have some version of this. Amateur radio is one of them. Obviously, the military and satellite capability are some others that we would all be incorporating to try and use. It's going to be a patchwork. There is no silver bullet. There will never be a silver bullet in communications. But this certainly is one of the top ones that we put in into our gun first to help use and support the citizens of the state. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Chair,
yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is not that expensive for people to do. I purchased 2 8-watt handheld shortwave, or the ham radio, basically, and I have to get a license for it, which is fine. That's not very difficult to do. But I did that for a little over $100. And 8 watt is that's a pretty decent radio, you know. But what that is more to me is to listen to what's going on than gabbing on, because I don't need to gab on it. But I do need to get the information off of it. And if everything is gone, example, what happens if electricity's gone? The only thing you have left is you either have a generator or you have some kind of a communication device, and it'll be to your ham radio operators. And it's very cheap to do.
Yeah, Representative Esquivel, you're right. The preparedness kit, one of the things that Director Phelps encourages is that hand operated or battery operated weather radio, just to get the messaging.
Just to get the message.
To find out what's going on. It's pretty cheap stuff.
Yeah, you can buy those as well, where they're
even cheaper than
the crank type,
sir.
Or the solar or both.
Sure.
Chair Lively, to that point, I would add I've participated in a number of exercises where we've essentially unplugged our emergency coordination center, and it's more than just voice that can be shared through amateur radio, but documents as well, digital files can be shared, and obviously that becomes more expensive than $100, but it's another lifeline that we have to share information and help establish and maintain that situational awareness, and I appreciate your interest.
If things are bad, I won't be asking for documents.
We very well
just for will.
That's right. Could you hand that in writing, please, to me?
So I appreciate the counties, the critical role the counties play at their level. So one of my questions goes back to, I guess, kind of an inventory understanding what their capabilities are, because if they set their own standards in that, so they could be different. In some cases, their standards are set around finances and how they afford it. So from a standpoint of the state, though, we need to be concerned about, is everybody to a certain level of capabilities, so something catastrophic happens, we're comfortable that those networks can work. And so I don't know, is there an inventory? I'm not trying to tell the counties their business, but I'm just trying to understand what role do we play in that, in ensuring, even though we do the extras, in that ensuring that if the worst case happens, is every county in the same position of being able to respond and provide that communication?
Chair Lively, we've done quite a bit of work with our counties and even our tribal partners across the state to establish sort of a baseline level of capability. I don't know how robust our inventory is of what each county has, but through our exercise program in particular, we're able to assess sort of that base level of capability. Again, a lot of these programs rely on volunteer efforts, so that always adds another dynamic to what capability will exist on a bad day here in Oregon. But it's something that we regularly check in with our county now several of our tribal partners to establish that connectivity.
Yeah, and I think the standards are very well set out in terms of how to operate and what it is. I mean, if you're in Aries County, if you operate under ARL, there are certain it's down to a science. It's not an art form. And the same with RACES. But whether or not we have that capability or a gap exists, most do pretty well. But there some of the more isolated counties, there's just less people. There's less volunteers.
And that's probably the issue, the volunteer. Sure, go ahead.
Mr. Chair. I was wondering, Dave, do you think we could get the county's plans, have them send them to us, and you could look at them and scrutinize them and let us know? Because I can't believe that every county would be different, every county, of course. But, you know, I mean, maybe we can help them help themselves if there's things that are holes in their plan.
Chair Lively, Representative Esquivel, we can certainly help produce that. There's the EOP, the Emergency Operations Plans for the counties and the state, is a baseline product that OEM has established across all counties. But in terms of what the actual capability on the ground is, we can also provide that assessment to you as well.
So I think you mentioned earlier about at some point, some years ago, the state made some investment in some infrastructure and has, are you going to explain that to us?
I wasn't involved with that purchase, if you...
Well, then, okay. I'd just like to understand, because I'm worried about, again, capabilities and what role the state played then versus what we can do now, and especially the capabilities of maintaining the equipment or that infrastructure so that... If it's battery operated, the batteries, I mean, there's things like that. It can sit out there for 20 years.
How do you charge them?
Yeah.
That's the key.
In the wake of 2007, we asked Governor Kongoski to put in about $250,000 and Vince and the folks basically picked out the kind of equipment that would be a force multiplier. Mm-hmm. They were deployed out to many of the counties, and the idea was that by having that capability, it would raise amateur radio folks that wanted to participate into kind of a higher spectrum of use. Uh-huh. At that time, it was understood as an initial capitalization. There were no funds in OEM at that point for sustainment of that, and we were basically trying to, at that point, prepare for the next storms with a discussion in the future of how we would sustain it statewide.
And have we had that discussion?
We've not, I don't think.
Chair Lively, Representative Evans, some of these systems operate on Microsoft products. You know, right. There's a laptop associated to them. It's not just a radio. If you're picturing this,
right.
This is a little bit beyond just a standard radio.
Sure.
And so just prior to Director Phelps coming on board, we created a sustainment package to try and surge them past whatever the Microsoft version they are. But then the counties had to pick it up, and we created this method of, okay, now that you've owned this since 2007,
right.
We just bought it and upgraded it for you. But now from this point forward,
right.
You're going to have to do it on your own because the money doesn't exist out there, and so that's how we're trying to sustain. Quite frankly, it's not a very good method. We kept it going for about 8 years, and now the counties are going to have to keep it up.
And see, I guess that's from my standpoint, that's my concern. This isn't a criticism of the county or anybody else. I mean, technology, both it ages with this Microsoft product, or secondly, you know, there's other things that go wrong, and it just concerns me. We made investment, or they make investments, and there's always these budget things. If we're serious about being prepared, then for my part, one of the real serious parts of that is this whole communication things. And if we've got equipment that's 10 years old out there and doesn't work anymore, and we haven't done a very good job of being prepared. And from my standpoint, I don't think the state can walk away from some obligation from our part to ensure. I thought it was great what you did, but then if you didn't maintain it. So I'm just trying, you know, to make sure we understand that,
sure,
where that fits and what the role the state can play to help it, because I just don't, in case of emergency, it won't do any good to point at the guy over there that says, well, you know, our software is 10 years old, so it doesn't work. That doesn't solve the problem.
Yeah.
Chair Lively, at the time, I remember the discussions because we looked at different options. And I think at least the philosophy, and this does not speak to how we pay for it now, but the philosophy was that the state could help the counties by at least making sure that the EOC could get information into the state system.
In the state
and
system. Yeah.
That we upgraded it to where, and again, I don't know the terminology, but we could actually put word and information packets over the spectrum as opposed to having
data.
It to be verbal, which was the quantum shift that we were trying to get them into. But just because of the Great Recession and everything else, I think those conversations, people talked about it, but there just wasn't money to go forward.
Yeah, I agree with you, Mr. Chair. Why would we even start something if we're not going to follow through with it? That's what it boils down to. And I think that we should ask as a committee, if we aren't up to date on this stuff or if we have dropped the ball, then it's our responsibility to make sure that we ensure that our counties have the best possible advantage.
It is some of it becomes very cost prohibitive. There's things that we've tried to stay away from. Reverse 911, it can be very, very, very costly across this state when you start contracting with companies to try and notify. So but the communications package, this package that we bought, the state bought, mm-hmm. It's a good package, and we've tried to maintain it, and we can certainly provide that assessment for you.
Yeah, I just think that would be, even if we get to the point, we have the conversation, we decide, at least we had the conversation, we know what the risk is. We need to decide what the risk is and do it instead of just, it happened in 2008 and so many other things happened, we don't have the conversation again. Those are the things, I guess, concern me when we're talking about people's lives that are dependent upon instant communications. It just doesn't make sense to me that we wouldn't at least keep asking. So I would appreciate whatever you can do that way to bring us up to speed. Then we can talk about if there's a, you know,
and Mr. Chair,
forward.
Make sure that we as a committee know what we can do to help.
Yeah.
Sure. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you. Thank you for your efforts. We're going to all become ham radio operators too, evidently.
Yeah, I don't know. You have to pass a license.
Oh, well, that
before you can get on.
Before you get on, that may not work. Some of us, anyway.
And it's very complex, that thing. It's got a lot of little numbers on it.
Okay, so now we're going to talk about impediments, and not necessarily all impediments, but local emergency planning. And partly what has created this conversation is during the last session, we had several conversations, hearing from local communities and others about how well they're prepared, about what's working or what's not working. We heard, I think maybe just our last September legislation, we heard some about land use planning and the role land use planning plays, both from a standpoint of currently and how well people are able to comply with that, or where there might be conflicts between how we wrote our land use law rules around each one of our community in the days when we wrote it versus where we are today. And so my intent in having this conversation, just explore more where some of those things, this isn't a, the intent of this conversation isn't we're not going to rewrite Senate Bill 100, but find out, you know, kind of the status of Goal 7 and how that works or doesn't work, and how it's, if it doesn't work because people can't comply with it because they don't have the resources to do it, then what role the state might play with that, but identify other things within there. Especially probably, again, leading more towards 2017 if we need to do something from the legislator standpoint. And it may be resources in that. So we've invited some people here today to help talk about those issues that we've heard quite a bit about before. So I think it's Josh, Bruce, yes, and Matt, and Ion. So the state geologists will be able to give us information on how long it takes for that. Okay, that's what I thought.
Should we answer that question or after?
Yeah, well, we might. See, that's what I'm thinking. We might want to, because again, I was at a presentation in Eugene where Josh and many others did, and that was one of the topics that was there, and we talked about that. So whoever. Oh, wait. Well, we don't want to answer the question right. Thank you. Until Representative Escobar is back. Chair, introduce yourself.
Chair Lively, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to discuss challenges and opportunities related to emergency planning in Oregon. My name is Josh Bruce. I'm the director of the Oregon Partnership for Disaster Resilience. It's a program based in the University of Oregon's Community Service Center. For the record, I also serve on the board of the Cascadia Region Earthquake Work Group and am a member of the Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association Policy Advisory Committee, where I essentially help my planning colleagues think about natural hazards and how to comment on policy. I'm joined today by Ian Maiden. He's the interim state geologist and director of the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. Mr. Maiden's worked with the agency for 28 years, specializing in mapping and assessment of natural hazards and risks. Also on the panel with me today from the Department of Land Conservation and Development are Dan Eisenbeiss and Patty Snow. Dan is the legislative coordinator for DLCD, freshly to the agency. And Patty manages the department's work with local governments on ocean and coastal resources. Before we get started with the presentations, I want to acknowledge that there's been a real and significant shift in the attention being paid to natural hazard and emergency planning in Oregon. Recent winter storms, the ongoing drought, this summer's wildfires, and the ever-increasing probability of a Cascadia subduction zone earthquake and tsunami are all forcing community and state conversations about hazard planning. Climate change considerations, aging infrastructure, homelessness, poverty, among other community issues, only add to our sense of community vulnerability. And that says nothing about the human and technological threats that emergency managers continue to contend with. The recent events at Umpqua Community College provide a pretty stark and devastating example of the range of threats that our local emergency management professionals have to consider and prepare for on a daily basis. The increased attention being paid to hazard and emergency planning issues is translating into real and significant progress. And numerous individuals across public, private, and non-governmental organization sector partners have to be commended for the advances that are being made in disaster preparation, mitigation, recovery, and response. And this is especially true considering the bureaucratic and resource constraints that do exist across local, regional, and state scales. And one only needs to consider the budget allocated for development of the Oregon Resilience Plan to understand that point. I mean, that was a tremendous effort, and it only happened really with a bunch of volunteers getting together to do that. You know, I would argue that with some more budget, it's only what we could imagine what that plan could be. However, despite the gains being made, there remain significant impediments to an enterprise-wide approach to hazard planning and community resilience in our state. I applaud this committee's important and ongoing work to improve resilience of our state, specifically Representative Boone's leadership on Cascadia resilience, and I'd personally like to thank Representative Lively for the invitation today. So to begin the presentations, Mr. Maiden will discuss the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries' efforts to improve the detail and accuracy of hazard information and prepare comprehensive hazard planning maps and other tools for the state and communities to use. Ms. Snow will follow Mr. Maiden with an overview of the Department of Land Conservation and Development's efforts to support hazard planning efforts across the state. And then I'll wrap up the presentation with my assessment of important hazard planning challenges and opportunities. Our intent is to leave some time at the end for questions and discussion, and I'll now turn the mic over to Mr. Maiden with the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Lively, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ian Maiden. I'm the Interim State Geologist and Director of the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, or TOGAMI. Thanks for the opportunity to come down and talk to you about TOGAMI's part in emergency planning and providing information for communities and other agencies. Oregon occupies a young landscape. Its coast, mountains, valleys, and deserts are still being shaped by the geologic forces of plate tectonics. Our spectacular scenery comes with a price, which is geologic hazards, including earthquakes, tsunamis, landslides, floods, coastal erosion, and volcanic hazards. These hazards come with different amounts of warning and with varied frequency and geographic extent, but one thing that they all share is that the risk depends entirely on location. This means that geologists can map the areas where the hazard is likely to be greatest and can overlay inventories of buildings, population, and infrastructure on those hazard maps to determine the risks in every community. So the first slide that I'm showing you here provides some examples of the kinds of hazard and risk map that the agency produces. On the upper right, we have a landslide hazard map for Tillamook County that we're currently working on. On the right, upper right, we have a volcano hazard map for the Upper Sandy River. This is looking at areas that would be impacted by debris flows from an eruption of Mount Hood. On the lower left, we have a risk map for downtown Coos Bay with the buildings color-coded in terms of the amount of damage they can expect in a 100-year flood. And finally, the lower right is an image showing the erosion hazard zones for the community of Neskowin. We believe that the critical need for community emergency planning is the development of consistent, comprehensive, accurate, and detailed hazard and risk information like this covering all Oregon communities. Currently, this information is only available for a couple of communities. So I'm going to walk you through some of these hazards with just give you a little bit of information about the kinds of things we know about them, what we think we can do about them. And one thing that I do want to point out, because I'm really proud of my staff, is that in most of the instances that I'm showing you here, the work that we're doing is at the cutting edge of technology and in many cases is a national model for other organizations. So with respect to flood hazards, we know that about 12% of the land area of all the urban growth areas in Oregon cities lies within the 100-year floodplain. Increased rainfall projected to accompany future climate change will increase the frequency of damaging floods. We're already seeing that happening, and will expand the area at risk. Using highly accurate topographic maps made with LIDAR, which is an airborne laser scanning system, TOGAMI makes accurate maps of the areas subject to future flooding and produces detailed maps of risk and estimates of loss and damage. Western Oregon is one of the most landslide-prone parts of the United States, perhaps even the world. Areas of high or very high landslide susceptibility cover 12% of Oregon's urban growth areas, and areas of moderate hazard cover an additional 24%. Landslides driven by high rainfall will become more common as climate change leads to more intense precipitation, and the next Cascadia earthquake will trigger movement in tens of thousands of existing or new landslides. By combining detailed inventories of landslides with geologic data and accurate maps of slopes, TOGAMI produces detailed and accurate maps of landslide susceptibility and risk. Oregon's coast is subject to one of the most energetic wave climates in the world. And we know that 50 miles of coastline within the urban growth areas of Clatsop, Tillamook, and Lincoln counties have a very high potential for coastal erosion. Wave energy in the biggest winter storms has increased significantly in the last few decades and is expected to continue to increase with climate change. By studying the nearshore bathymetry and topography and geology of the coast, Dogami maps the areas that are most at risk for future erosion. Oregon faces earthquake hazards throughout the state. Virtually all of the urban growth areas west of the Cascades will experience moderate to heavy damage in the event of a magnitude 9 subduction zone earthquake, and many eastern Oregon communities are also at risk from smaller earthquakes on local faults. Dogami uses computer models of earthquake shaking to estimate economic losses, casualties, shelter and debris disposal needs, and recovery times for critical services. And it's the slide here, I just wanted to remind everyone that we are a mirror image of the Tohoku area of Japan. Their earthquake is our future. Future Cascadia subduction zone earthquakes will cause tsunamis that will sweep away low-lying coastal communities within a half an hour of the earthquake. We know that 54,000 buildings lie within the worst-case tsunami inundation zone, and we expect few of those to survive. Dogami has produced comprehensive state-of-the-art tsunami inundation maps and evacuation maps for the entire coast, and we can use this information to determine varying levels of risk within coastal communities and to make new evacuation models that allow city officials and residents to plan for their evacuation and to test models of changes in infrastructure that may enhance the ability to evacuate these areas. So Dogami has developed expertise and technology to prepare these kinds of comprehensive geologic hazard and risk maps for all Oregon communities. The efforts are currently funded almost entirely by competitive grants from the federal government with small contributions from cities, counties, and the state general fund, which results in a patchwork of progress. The slide here gives an example of one of these studies we're currently working on. We're using competitive funds that we obtained through FEMA to do the complete suite of hazard and risk mapping for Tillamook County. I'm not going to go into the details of all the little graphs, but each one of those shows for each community, for a particular hazard, the number of buildings that are affected, the value of the buildings that are affected, the percentage of the buildings in the community that are involved. Again, we have the ability to do this, but we have to go out and compete for the funding. So it goes without saying that stable and consistent funding would allow Dogami to complete this mapping process within a few biennia. And with that, I'd be happy to answer questions.
So you're going to answer the question regarding how long it would take for us to...
Chair Lively, members of the committee, the question about how much warning we would have. If the earthquake were to occur within the next few years, you would have no warning. The earthquake would be the first indication. The shaking would be the first indication you would have. Okay. There is an earthquake early warning system that is in its very infant stages of deployment in the Pacific Northwest. Once that network is fully deployed, depending on where the earthquake starts, depending on where you are, you probably could have as much as 30 seconds to a minute of warning under reasonably good conditions. Theoretically, you could have 4 minutes, but that's if everything is absolutely perfect, if the earthquake starts up at Vancouver and you are down in Northern California. But we do expect the system to be able to deliver 30 seconds, minute kind of warning within perhaps 10 years.
So if the earthquake happens on the coast, so how long before we feel the shaking? If we get to an early warning system, we might be warned 30 seconds or a minute, but if once the earthquake occurs, how long before we would feel the shaking here? Is there some...
So, I mean, again, it depends on where you are. And part of the problem is that this distinction between a Cascadia subduction zone earthquake and a kind of a California standard earthquake...
Different game.
In California, you talk about an epicenter. Yeah. The earthquake comes from a point. That's not the case in the Cascadia subduction zone. It comes from the entire coastline of Northern California, Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia. And in essence, a magnitude 9 is like having 30 magnitude 8s go off in succession. And so it really matters where that process starts and where you are with respect to it. But the idea of the early warning system is that the electronic signals travel much faster than the shaking. But just for argument's sake, if the earthquake originated immediately west of us off the coast, the shaking would probably take maybe 20 seconds or 30 seconds to get here. And so if that's where
can
it starts,
can we convene outside, please?
but the warning system in that case would only probably give you 10 or 15 seconds of notice.
Right, before the shaking would start. But it goes back, and I don't mean to belabor, but it goes back to even when you first start the shaking. If I remember the presentation Eugene we saw, there's this kind of start shaking, and it doesn't just do it all at once. And then, so as part of it, even the warning is because there's a period you're going to go through, however long that lasts, in which you have to be reacting to.
Yes, and we, you know, with magnitude 9 earthquakes, we anticipate the shaking to go on for 5 minutes.
Yeah. Anybody have any other questions right now? Sure, go ahead.
Ballpark. Thank you for that, Chair. Ballpark, do we have any idea how many of the many thousands of structures and homes and everything in the potentially affected area have insurance or supports or, like, the other question to that is that once we start identifying this and labeling it and becoming smarter about the size of the problem, are we in some ways opening a door for people that don't have insurance to have a harder time to get insurance?
Well,
Chair Lively, Representative Evans, I frankly don't know the percentage of structures that have earthquake insurance, and I could certainly try to look that up for you. Earthquake insurance is, we would rather see people reinforce structures and homes so that they remain usable after the event, so that they can shelter in place, then rely on insurance to rebuild. But obviously, insurance is an option for many people. I suspect that the prices of insurance has been going up because of increased awareness of the problem. But I will try and get you a number for that.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. Okay, thank you very much. So,
do musical chairs here.
Chair Lively, members of the committee, for the record, Daniel Eisenbeiss with the Oregon Department of Land Conservation and Development. Thank you for the invitation to be here today. As Mr. Bruce mentioned, I'm new in my position at the department, and this is the first committee that I'm testifying to in that capacity. I want to point out that posted on OLIS, we have written testimony that offers a fair amount of detail on the department's ongoing efforts to work with local communities to plan for natural hazards mitigation, steps we are taking to improve those efforts, as well as challenges and opportunities we see related to the need for better information, risk assessment, and staff resources. Patty Snow, our Ocean and Coastal Services Division Manager, is going to talk more about that, and we're both happy to take questions when she's done.
Thank you.
Chair Lively and members of the committee, this is Patty Snow again from the Ocean and Coastal Services Division at DLCD. The department works extensively with our local government partners to plan for mitigation of natural hazards, and that's what we'll be talking to you about today. Many of our efforts have focused on the two main impediments we feel there are for emergency preparedness planning, and that's inadequate information and risk assessment and insufficient staff resources. I think you'll hear that a number of times today. Local governments may... through Goal 7, in fact, they need to address through their land use planning authority and through the application of Planning Goal 7, which is for natural hazards, which establishes land use measures. They need to adopt comprehensive plans to reduce risk to people and property from natural hazards. And again, all cities and counties in the state of Oregon have acknowledged comprehensive plans with a Goal 7 element, but realizing that these were done 25 to 30 years ago. And at that time, we did have a floodplain mapping, for example. So all cities and counties with floodplain risk in the county, in the state, actually address floodplain hazards in their plan. So given that, however, not all the plans have been updated to address the recent information that we have. So the different sorts of hazards that Goal 7 includes: floods, landslides, earthquakes, tsunamis, coastal erosion, and wildfires. There may be others, but those are really the main ones. And, of course, the specific needs for addressing natural hazards from a tsunami, and I'm going to be focusing on the coastal area, as I think that's what you were wanting us to focus on, really depends on the development patterns, geography, and that sort of thing. For example, seaside, over 90%, as I understand it, of their structures are within the tsunami inundation zone, whereas places like Newport, parts of it, South Beach, would be more susceptible, but other parts are higher. So the different communities are going to definitely have different risks associated with tsunami hazards. Our efforts with local governments have focused on four areas. Collaborating with communities to substantially increase their resilience to natural hazards. This is a wide variety of strategies we've used, including assisting communities with UGB expansions, urban growth boundary expansions, trying not to be too planner-ese here, and helping them with land use permits for locating or relocating community assets away from vulnerable areas. Also, we work very closely with the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries and others to support local communities in carrying out risk assessments to understand their vulnerabilities to natural hazards. Third, we develop practical guidance and model ordinances and provide technical assistance to communities to assist them in developing actions to reduce or mitigate risks. And finally, we seek and provide financial resources as we can to bolster our and local government staffing to work on these needs. So have a number of examples. There's more detail in the written materials. I won't go through in huge detail, but we do have a small Newport office where we have three staff that work out of that office, and that provides much of our guidance and technical assistance to coastal communities. Our staff works actively with those local governments to address emergency preparedness efforts, and have a number of examples for you. In February of 2013, LCDC, our commission, adopted rule amendments that allows the siting of storage structures for emergency supplies outside of urban growth boundaries and forest zones. Mm-hmm. And subsequent to that, Cannon Beach and Clatsop County did provide for that and also have a plan amendment to have some of those. And as I understand, they have a number of them, and they're planning to put more of those structures. In 2013, for example, Cannon Beach purchased 55 acres of vacant forest land at the south east corner of the city as a potential relocation site for critical facilities, public safety buildings, school, emergency shelter. With assistance from our staff, the site has been annexed into the city limits, and the city staff is currently working with our staff on a phased approach to a UGB expansion at the site to accommodate future utility extensions. And of course, the city is finding, not surprisingly, that developing that property to support those critical facilities will require a substantial public investment, and so we're anticipating that our North Coast partners, as you can imagine. And then the city of Seaside, that I know you've heard from prior to this. In 2010, the department worked with the city of Seaside and the Seaside School District in their effort to facilitate the relocation of the Seaside schools. As you may have heard, I'm sure you've heard, all of their schools are in the tsunami inundation zone. And so they were looking for a site where they could relocate all their schools outside of the inundation zone. There was no such site within the urban growth boundary, so they've identified a site just adjacent to the UGB. And so we worked with them on that, and we're continuing to provide technical support to the city. And I should say that with the support of the department, the city did adopt criteria in their plan to address these changes to their plan for the UGB expansion. Unfortunately, the district did have a bond recently, well, in 2013, but that failed. And so at this point, as I understand it, the motion to annex that area is on hold. And did want to mention also that several years ago, the department helped the city of Vernonia expand their urban growth boundary to provide a new location for schools. As you've seen from slides from Mr. Maiden, the city is quite prone to flood hazards. It flooded in 1996 and again in 2007, and I believe your slide was from even more recently. We provided Vernonia with a planning grant to analyze potential school sites, and ultimately the city did do an urban growth boundary amendment, and that succeeded without appeal. I would like to point that out, because lots of folks think that there's not a possibility to do an urban growth boundary amendment without an appeal, which I know there's been quite a few. Let's see, the final example want to give. Actually, this is Neskowin also, which you've heard about, which actually is not an incorporated community, but it's in Tillamook County, which suffers, unfortunately, from a great deal of erosion. And I believe you heard from the County Commissioner, Mark Labhart, earlier this year about this effort, but I did want to mention this briefly. Actually, we've got quite a few slides with this. We worked with the county over a number of years to identify an appropriate hazard overlay zone in response to coastal erosion that the community was experiencing. So we provided technical assistance. So just as a background, the Neskowin community reached out to the county reached out to us, and this provides a little bit of the history. It was 7 years in the making. The community residents were very, they attended a Climate Ready Communities workshop with us, and soon after that, they formed a local committee. They learned about the hazard. The state agencies worked with the committee and the community. And what happened with it, there was the products, there was an engineering analysis that was primarily paid for locally, and a number of different plan and code amendments to increase resilience to erosion that I won't go into details, but you've got in your written testimony if you'd like. And we feel the quality of the work was very high. We believe it's an excellent model for other communities on the coast that are experiencing erosion. And as you saw from Mr. Ian's presentation, we've got quite a bit of the coast that's subject to severe erosion. And Neskowin's work has been incorporated into our coastal hazard model land use code. So some of the keys to success we saw there, we had motivated, hardworking, and capable citizens group. But we'll come to this again, that really for plan amendments to be successful, the community and the local government really has to support it. So we feel very strongly about that if we can provide the information through Dogami and other resources, if we can provide technical assistance and money to them if possible, then that's really when you succeed, is when you've got all of those things working together. So I just want to point out that really was one of the keys here, is that the citizens wanted it, the county wanted it, the elected officials wanted it. We provided technical assistance and some monetary assistance. And I'm going to go back here. It actually was subject to an appeal through LUBA, and we assisted the county in that, and the prevailed, and so it's in effect at this point. So I think that's a success story I wanted to mention. Next, another important piece is information and risk assessment, and you heard from Dogami about some of those pieces. Certainly recognizing and comprehending the scope of the problem is the first step in addressing a problem. And so for coastal communities, that does require having accurate maps and data that clearly shows where those risks are. And next, they need to know where the buildings are and the other vulnerable structures and vulnerable facilities. So combining the hazards and vulnerability information creates a risk assessment, which is the foundation for planning how to reduce or mitigate that risk. So, of course, Dogami provides much of the hazards data and mapping that local governments use. In a recent example of collaborative interagency work to address hazards, we provided funding to Dogami to evaluate rivers throughout the state for potential channel migration during floods, which is something that FEMA and actually National Marine Fisheries Service are really starting to look at. And so this is information that Dogami is just starting to gather and looking at a high statewide level to see where in the future, as we have resources, they'll concentrate on identifying these channel migration zones. Another important source of hazard data and mapping is risk map, and that's what's showing up there, which is a mapping analysis and planning program that's funded by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, and it's coordinated through our department. Currently, projects are underway all along the entire coast to update flood hazard zones maps, and then those will feed into hazard analysis conducted by Dogami and for the coastal counties. So you can see the whole coast is being updated as we speak. Did want to mention that last session we did propose a policy option package 107 that would have initiated a project to significantly improve the statewide risk assessment. Previous risk assessments in the Oregon Natural Hazard Mitigation Plan have been general and qualitative, and so the project would have developed an analytic framework and computer model that would allow comparison between hazards within a region and then comparisons between regions. The next thing I wanted to get to was model language and process improvement. After recognizing the risk, the next step in addressing hazards is to identify what actions that the communities can take to mitigate the risk. The department recently prioritized agency resources to publish a substantial new guidance document, and there's a live link in your document there, and I can point out what it looks like. It's preparing for a Cascadia Subduction Zone Tsunami, a land use guide for Oregon coastal communities. And this is through federal funding that we were able to do this, and we worked with a consultant, and we looked actually across the world internationally for sources, and there really was very little. So we basically developed it, and actually a number of like island communities, Samoa, for example, and Hawaii have been very interested in this because, of course, they have substantial tsunami risk as well. So I'll go through a little bit more because I think this is a really important key for us and how we're helping local governments. We provided the guidance, and now we're reaching out to any local government that will work with us, and they are very interested actually because they know through the new tsunami inundation maps that Dogami has released in the last several years that they are what their hazard really is for the first time, and so they want to address it. They're actually anxious to do that. So we felt that we really needed to provide that guidance to them. And it answers, actually, it's in partly response to the Oregon Resilience Plan. And it's focused on land use approaches, and it's not intended to address the full range of efforts that are needed for tsunami preparedness. So again, it's to help vulnerable communities incorporate tsunami resilience measures into their comprehensive plan. And I did want to say that right now, currently, Clatsop County has been drafting amendments that incorporate the land use guide into their plan. Coos County, we're working with Cannon Beach. It's just an example of a number of communities they're working with us to incorporate that guidance into their plans. Let's see. What's in the guide? That's probably a little more information than you need. We first released it in 2014 and then updated it earlier this year with a new chapter on tsunami evacuation facilities improvement plan, which is kind of a mouthful, but we felt that was really important for local governments to really address these hazards in their plan. I wanted to go on to say that the department has also prepared guidance and model development for addressing chronic coastal erosion, and we've updated that now. The NESCOWIN plan that we talked about, adaptation plan, used our model ordinance, and then they improved on it, and so now we've incorporated those improvements into our model ordinance. And we will be working to prepare model regulations addressing landslide hazards and helping the communities adopt regulations in response to the new landslide inventory and susceptibility maps that are being produced by Dogami. And the last thing I wanted to say under this section was that the department is currently working to implement House Bill 2254, which was passed unanimously in 2013, which was a department-sponsored bill to improve the urban growth boundary amendment process. And although planning for natural hazards has been a part of the UGB amendment process for some time, this bill, 2254, and the implementing rules make it more explicit how and when a city can exclude from consideration for expansion land that is subject to significant development hazards, including risk of tsunami inundation, and further allow cities to discount the development capacity of certain lands already in the growth boundary. And our commission will actually be hearing those rules here in just a couple weeks. And so we're hoping that the result is a process that more clearly directs development away from hazard areas and over the long term creates more resilient communities. Finally, money. This is what we believe is really the most significant impediment to local plan updates to addressing hazards is staff resources, both the local and the state level. Local mitigation actions have to be tailored to local conditions, and that requires work by local government staff. We can assist them, and consultants can as well if there's resources available, but it still requires effort by local governments to do that. Recently, what have we done? The department has worked with the Office of Emergency Management to apply for federal funding for local natural hazard mitigation plans, and we were awarded $215,000, which will provide funding for Beaverton, Medford, Albany, and Tillamook County, including its cities, and it will allow them to update their natural hazard mitigation plans and then integrate those plans into their comprehensive plans. We were also successful in obtaining a $40,000 federal grant from FEMA to help Curry County. And that money will help fund local and state staff working together to integrate local natural hazard mitigation planning into the comprehensive plan. Earlier this year, DLCD staff worked in collaboration with Dogami and others to apply for a National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration Community Coastal Resilience Grant to the tune of over $600,000. And the grant would provide substantial resources related to tsunami resilience and would include important time and distance modeling for a number of high-risk Oregon coastal communities, and then also implementation of tsunami resilience strategies, options, and requirements within a number of those communities, utilizing our land use planning guide for tsunamis. We should learn whether that grant was successful by the end of this month. I also wanted to mention there are state resources that have been available. The department offers grants to local governments funded by the legislature for $1.5 million for the 15-17 biennium, and that's for statewide for everything, planning assistance for local governments. This year, the department did add natural hazards. It's one of identification and mitigation is one of the priorities for these general fund planning assistance grants. And the grant funding available represents one-third of the amount that's requested by applicants. And we did get quite a number of very good applications this year, but at the most, we're going to be able to fund a third of it with the general fund resources we have available. And lastly, in the coastal program, we have historically supported coastal planning, including natural hazards planning, for all coastal communities using federal funds that come through our NOAA grant under the Coastal Zone Management Act. However, as you may know, there was a lawsuit in Oregon against the Coastal Non-Point Source Pollution Plan. And as a result of that, NOAA and EPA determined that the state's program, that our water quality standards aren't adequate to protect coastal water quality. And specifically, feel more than free to ask me about any details afterwards, but at this point, it's forestry issues that they have found are not compliant. And as a result of that, NOAA has cut a third of our coastal grant that we normally receive, and because of that, we haven't been able to provide any of those federally funded coastal assistance grants to local governments this year. In summary, we fully support the integration of natural hazard considerations into local land use planning to further the resilience of our at-risk communities, and we're working with those communities to develop approaches that achieve that integration. Again, we feel that the greatest impediments to emergency preparedness being incorporated in planning results from insufficient staff resources, and of course, development of better information and risk assessment is also an issue. And we're committed to working and collaborating with our local governments to the maximum extent that we can. And Dan and I are more than willing to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much. Certainly. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Lively. I have a couple questions and a congratulations. I applaud the department. In 2007, there was not quite the energy and excitement about adjusting boundaries for natural hazards. And I'm very glad to hear and see that is moving forward, and I think that's a good change. It was uncomfortable there for a little bit, but I'm glad it's where it's at. I really have two questions. One is, when you said appeal, that one of the cities, I think it was Seaside or somebody, made, got a land use adjustment, even though there was an appeal. My question is, what standing does someone have to appeal when it's a public safety request?
That was the Neskowin Erosion right. Adaptation Plan, right. And a couple of which had huge community support, but there was a landowner, actually two, that felt that especially the setbacks and everything would reduce their property value. So they appealed the ordinance to the LUBA, but it didn't prevail. The appeal didn't prevail.
So a follow-up, if I could, on that. Would it be helpful for legislation that weights it in a particular way for public safety? They do it in certain court cases for different purposes, and you know, prevailing versus 50%, 70%, whatever it is. But it seems to me that if it's for public safety and we're trying to actually reduce the cost, meaning trying to stretch every dollar we can, spending money on defending an appeal, which is eyes open, a public safety move, not for speculation, not for anything else, that seems like a waste of money to me. So that's something, if you're interested in, maybe that's something we can pick up on. The second question, in addition to standing, you have done fine work, clearly, on the coast. My question, and again, maybe to Dogami as well, in the valley where our concern with the tsunami is not as much of water-land balance, but rather liquefaction, Do we have a way of looking and identifying areas that are more susceptible than less to liquefaction? And if so, is that something we should look in our 20-year inventory for, not building factories upon the sand, but rather building it upon the rock?
I think I will defer to
Oh, I got a microphone. Even better. So that's exactly the kind of thing that we can and do map. Liquefaction hazards are totally related to geology. We have mapped them in detail in many communities, but we could do it throughout the Willamette Valley. And you're exactly right. It does not make any sense to develop anything on areas of high liquefaction potential. The cost of remediation for that kind of land is extremely high.
So, as a follow-up, if I could. Sure. So is that work there, and I'm sure it's been shared with LCDC, but is, again, on the weighting system, when I was a mayor and we were trying to figure out how to fit what was going to develop over the next 20 years, urban growth boundary, et cetera, we were saying, all right, X amount for industry, this, that, and the other thing. We didn't really think about liquefaction and think about a lot of these things. Mm-hmm. But it was often hard to justify to the department, we need to expand this area because we want to versus, well, we can't build here anyway. So is there a formula now where those areas can basically be excluded from the inventory so it's not basically forcing folks to try to advertise in areas that can't be built?
I'll talk a little bit about the my side of this, but the LCD may need to talk about whether there's actually exclusions or policy changes. So although it is possible to accurately identify those liquefaction areas, we have only done so for the entire state at a very broad level. Right. And we have only dialed in to produce maps that are accurate enough that I would feel comfortable about people making land use decisions with them in a few communities. So that's part of the problem, is having accurate enough information.
Sure.
As to what people do with that information, what mechanisms there are, I'll have to defer.
Chair Lively, Representative Evans, that's a good question. Off the top of my head, I can't tell you specifically, but I can tell you that the legislation that Patty mentioned that the department is implementing to simplify the urban growth boundary process does include provisions to discount the land supply within an urban growth boundary when land is constrained by various natural hazards or by development restrictions for purposes of protecting or mitigating the risk related to natural hazards. So I'd be happy to follow up with you when I learn more specifically about that question.
Could we see the criteria for when that develops out? I'd like to know what the planning commissions across the state are looking at when they're saying we can or we can't list this area as a natural hazard area. I think that there might be some ways the state could help with at least some of the marketing of some of those areas as those decisions get made.
Josh, did you have?
Yeah, just wanted to offer my perspective, which is these issues get pretty complicated. Mm-hmm. And local really quick. And as a mayor, you'll appreciate it. I mean, let's take a blatant example of Seaside, right, and talk about the tsunami inundation zone. Mm-hmm. And it's, from my perspective, unrealistic to suggest that Seaside's going to pick itself up and move. Under a plain reading of Goal 7 would suggest, however, that development not be permitted in areas where the impacts of the hazard cannot be mitigated. So clearly we have a pretty complex issue now, right? And so, you know, my suggestion is these are community policy conversations that we need to have, and it's not as black and white as saying, no, we're not going to develop in a particular area. I think a more appropriate question is really, what percentage of our permanent residential housing stock do we want available after a certain disaster? Or what percentage of our economic engine do we want available? Which of our critical facilities do we want inside or outside? Those become more realistic and palatable conversations for local jurisdictions. And the compounding issues, using another example like Gold Beach, I mean, that's a community that really doesn't have anywhere to go that isn't hazard impact. You've got coastal erosion, tsunami inundation, you have flooding, you have landslide, you have wildfire. And so those become important trade-off conversations And I think what you hear me argue is those are some conversations that we need to be having more that we're not necessarily having now.
Right. If I could, and again, I say this from a person who actually puts more stock in local government than I do in state government in many cases, all right? Absolutely hear what you're saying. That said, in a finite environment with how much money we have to use and not use, my preference will always be towards some mitigation and response versus all in mitigation. Mm-hmm. And in some areas, you're absolutely right. We cannot tell the communities what they can and can't do, but we can absolutely make sure there's no state funds going in to enable a bad decision. We have finite amount of resources. And while sympathies with folks that may have bought a particular piece of property, and certainly no law saying you can't do something with it, it's one thing to try to help people make better decisions. It's another thing to actually be complicit in the crime of investing in areas that are nonsense areas. And I say that because when I was stationed in the South, there were a lot of people that built on barrier islands. And I was always bemused by saying, how are you getting insurance when you're on a barrier island? It is a barrier. That's the job of the barrier island. Why are you building a house here? And sometimes we have to, I think, be careful with the public purse, what we can and can't put in. Just a thought.
Representative Esquivel, do you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Evans hit on something that I think that we all should understand, and to my understanding, and that is about the appeal process to LUBA. I personally believe that you shouldn't be able to appeal unless you have standing or unless you have property that's contiguous to the land use issue, whatever you're developing. Having said that, I do think that it's okay that the property owners appeal to LUBA because, you know, the government isn't always right. You know, so I'm for that. But I do resent the fact that somebody from Armpit, Alabama can file a LUBA appeal that's never even seen the property. That's wrong. So we need to change that. I don't know if that's an administrative rule or I don't know if it's a statute, but that is just flat wrong. Thanks for the comment.
Sure. You put the staff in a tight spot. Josh, do you have some wrap-up remarks?
Yeah. A short presentation given the hour. I'll try and keep this brief. Chair Lively, members of the committee, sure. Thank you. Just for context, what's a guy from University of Oregon doing here? If you're not familiar with the Community Service Center, I want to just briefly describe what it is we do so you understand the space and the perspective that I'm bringing to the conversation. So the Community Service Center has been around close to 40 years, and essentially what we do, we're affiliated with the Planning, Public Policy, and Management Department at the University of Oregon. And we essentially provide assistance, capacity, and technical expertise to communities all over the state on a range of policy and planning issues. We like to say we link the energy and expertise of the university with the planning and policy needs of communities in Oregon. We do that really through a service learning model. So my partner Craig is in the back here. He's a graduate student in 3PM. Through his education in the classroom and through projects that we're providing, he gets a service learning opportunity. So he's going to be working with Marion County, leading a team of grad students to help update their natural hazard mitigation plan. So that's kind of how we work. Theory in the classroom and then give them real-life situations and hopefully train up the next generation of leaders in the state. We have a bunch of different focus areas. Natural hazards is only one of them. We do a lot of work in natural resources and social planning, community economic development. We have the Economic Development Administration University Center in our shops. We get EDA funds to help communities do economic development. Work a lot around energy, food systems. You can see the list. The reason I share that is because we kind of work in this space. We act kind of like a consultant, and so we're in the trenches with the locals trying to develop these plans. We work really closely with our state agency partners to get the data and the information and the tools and the resources and the money to help facilitate these processes. And because of that, we kind of see a bunch of different parts of the process. We're here today to talk about emergency planning, and so nobody's really set the context for that, but I think pretty broadly about what emergency planning entails. This is kind of a conceptual model that we've developed. This is idealistic, and I think it's safe to say that not many jurisdictions in Oregon kind of have this level of sophistication. The point here is that there's a lot of different plans, right, that emergency managers are thinking about. So to show that a little bit differently, you're all familiar with the emergency management cycle. Right? Response, mitigation, recovery, preparation. Within each of those quadrants, there's all kinds of different plans that might be in place. So you might have an emergency operations plan. That could include your local emergency planning committee hazardous materials plan, you know, public health pandemic plans. Under mitigation, you can have your community mitigation plan. Under the federal regs, through FEMA, you might also have a community wildfire protection plan that's under a completely different set of regs under the Healthy Forest Restoration Act. And so the point here is that emergency planning is a pretty complex and entailed and really takes a team approach to get it. And that's not to say anything about all of the plans communities have that might be related, but that we don't think of necessarily as emergency plans. Your community economic development strategy, for example, right? So that's just to suggest that there's a emergency planning. When you talk about that, we have to be thinking about all the elements of the emergency management cycle. I'm here to suggest that there's really, in my mind, two primary impediments to doing this kind of comprehensive, enterprise-wide sort of approach. One is lack of programmatic alignment. And part of that's, you know, with respect to the agencies that are represented here, we have OEM in the room. They're bringing budget packages together to you as departments, not necessarily as a team. Mm-hmm. I know there's a bunch of reasons for that, and it's super complicated. But from my perspective, I think that it challenges our ability to address some of these paradigms. The important thing to remember with resilience is it really has to transcend scale, right? Scale in both agency and in time, and so it's got to apply horizontally. Horizontally and vertically. The other impediment is limited capacity, and my colleagues have already talked about resources, and so I'll probably not spend a bunch of time on that. But I think the solution is we need adequate resources across all levels of government. So with respect to strategic coordination, I mean, the real issue becomes lack of alignment.
Can I talk to that for a second?
Sure.
All right. I agree with you, so I'm not jumping, and I appreciate everything you guys are doing. There once, in fact, in statute, there still is a very much smaller now Homeland Security Council, and in other states, Utah being an example, there is a very robust top-line strategic organization that works together to do what you're talking about, to talk about the alignments mm-hmm. and bring people together. It's something that the state did have. It's something that I think the state will have again in the future. So you please keep preaching about the alignment piece, because, again, one of the things that is frustrating about Oregon's history and governance is we are so afraid of the tyranny of the king, we sometimes have these silos that we take pride in, and it's not going to help when you have finite amounts of resources. So thank you for talking about the alignment issue.
Keep going.
Okay. You're welcome. So my primary issue is lack of alignment. This is a quote, actually, from a 2010 statewide survey we did on Goal 7. You know, talking about a lot of the plans that we do, they end up duplicating effort. They're trying to use the same data, but it's not always the same. And as a result, that can lead to confusion at the local level. It can lead to inefficiency where, you know, it's time to do the emergency operations plan. Will we do a vulnerability assessment or a threat assessment? And then it's time to do the mitigation plan. We do, a vulnerability assessment, a threat assessment. It's time to so there can be some efficiency issues. Sometimes it can result in multiple messages from different arenas, whether it be government or even researchers or whoever is working in the communities, on what is the appropriate response. And my experience is that what that leads to, in not all cases, I mean, Patty's already talked about some great examples where what we want to see happening is occurring, but in some cases, no action being taken. So solutions, obviously, like Representative Evans said, you know, we need ways to better connect these activities, encourage coordination, and that, at the end of the day, is going to take some vision of a program. Some leadership and some management. A quick example, right, is the new tsunami inundation maps that Department of Geology and Mineral Industries has put out. Part of the conversation here today is about Goal 7. We've got Department of Land Conservation and Development involved. We've got certainly Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, potentially even Oregon Emergency Management involved in that. And what the goal says is that we're supposed to consult, notify, and then the locals are supposed to respond to that. I'm going to argue, I think I've said this before, so I'm on record, it won't be a surprise to anybody in the room, that to date we haven't really had a formal consultation process. There hasn't been notification to all the jurisdictions on the coast, and as a result, we don't have uniform sort of response. Again, nothing to take away from the activities that are happening, and good work is being done in lots of communities, but when I go out and I'm trying to work with Coos County or Curry County to update their natural hazard mitigation plan, it's hard to know what to tell them if we don't have that consultation taking place. So my recommendation, and the nice thing about this, I don't think it takes much other than let's agree on what the administrative process is for when new hazard data is available. We sit down and talk. Questions that you guys can ask are, you know, what is the current consultation process? What can we learn from Senate Bill 12? Anybody remember the landslide bill? So after 96, 97, we had people killed from rapidly moving landslide. There was legislation directing local jurisdictions to do something about that in their comp plans. And Department of Geology and Mineral Industries did a great job of rolling out stuff. And at the local levels, this gets the capacity to say we don't have the resources to do the downscaled assessment. And so I don't know that we're any better off today, at least at a state level. Certainly in some communities, yes, but at a state level with landslide. How can the legislature reduce competition and promote coordination amongst these agencies, right? And I think part of that might be around how they present policy option packages. How can the state efforts directly serve local needs? How can we better connect mapping and analysis with planning? So let me move to the second issue, and again, I'll breeze through this quickly because you guys know the resources constraints at the state, regional, and at the local level in Oregon. The bottom line is we have pretty limited capacity at all of those different levels. And so what the outcomes are is now we have, you know, imagine an emergency manager in a small shop, you're one person trying to do all of that planning activity. And what results is it ends up being a lot of box checking and just struggling to keep up with the number of plans. You spend a lot of time looking for money, too. There's a disconnect between what the state strategy is and what a local strategy might be. And that all generates kind of some frustration and lack of trust oftentimes at the local level. So solutions are targeting resources, looking for multi-objective outcomes, right, where you can be you know, around this risk assessment issue, we've been preaching a lot. If we could have a comprehensive risk assessment that can feed the emergency operation plan and the mitigation plan and everything and address all of the different regulatory nuances, that would be great, because then the community only has to update one thing instead of five. And then thinking about this as an economic development strategy, in my mind, the only way that we're going to provide a cycle of investment is to really think about resilience as an economic development strategy. And so the example, hazard mitigation planning, you know, we've got a couple primary state agencies, again, Oregon Emergency Management. We have a state hazard mitigation officer, one state hazard mitigation officer for the entire state of Oregon, right, trying to manage grants and trying to manage projects. And we have Department of Land Conservation and Development with technical resources. The staffing constraints are real. And they mean we're not able to serve the local communities in the way that we need to. Oftentimes, the staff are also wearing multiple hats, and we know what that does. There's little to no redundancy, so there's not a lot of bench. When Dennis Sigrist retires, you know, goodness gracious, right? So the recommendation is to invest in capacity and technical assistance. You've heard that from others here today. questions you can ask: is one hazard mitigation officer enough for a state our size? Is one flood plan coordinator enough? Is multi-department programmatic funding an option? You know, again, thinking about a team approach. What does economic development have to do with emergency management? The nice thing about Economic Development Administration after Superstorm Sandy is they're all on board with resilience. They want to see disaster resilience as a part of a community's economic development strategy. There's opportunity there because that's where the business and the money and the private sector is. Ask ourselves, do we want to spend a dollar today on mitigation or $4, $5, $6, $10, $12 tomorrow after something bad happens? So again, two primary impediments. There's a bunch of other ones. This is a much longer and detailed conversation. Like I was alluding to in response to the question, this stuff gets nuanced really fast. It's complicated. But I'm here to argue that hazard planning, even within the field of planning, is essentially brand new. You know, it's Hurricane Katrina. It's those kind of events that are really turning us on to the fact that we need to do more around land use and these things. So thank you.
So the question remains, so one of the criticisms we hear a lot about land use planning is the time it takes to change the ship, to turn it. Now, we talked about 25 years ago, many of us developed our core plans. Now, the information that we're getting from Dagami and others, I mean, we're learning fascinating things about what the risks are, but we're still in a position that communities are developing and building based on current adopted plans that in some cases are doing just exactly what Representative Evans described. We're probably knowing we're building and doing things in places or not. So I guess the question goes back, so what do we need to do to not violate our tenets of land use planning and what we want to do, but yet change this process so don't keep investing money and time in those areas that makes no sense to invest in, but create the places we need to? Because first we've got to have everybody update their Goal 7 so we have some factual basis in which to make an argument of changes, and then you've got to go through the process of all the other goals and then the urban growth boundaries. I mean, we're talking about years. And it's not to suggest we don't have years. We might. I don't know. But I'm just trying to understand. So what, you know, where do we need to start pushing or shoving to comply with the intent of what our land use plan and things are, but to make sure we're not continuing to invest public money and private money in places that we're now getting information that tells us it makes no sense?
I think the best thing we can do is make sure the local governments have the information, which, at least for the tsunami inundation zones, they've got that. And then work with them to apply the land use guidance, the changes to that, like, say, Clatsop County, although they've come into a little bit of a buzzsaw now, but they were well along on the process to adopt plan amendments to address it, you know, basically restricting development in certain areas. It's similar to what Tillamook County did in the Neskowin. So I think where we've got the information and where we've got the political will, if you will, and technical assistance and resources to actually do it, I think you've got communities that want to do that. Whether it's Cannon Beach, whether it's Clatsop County, Coos County, we're not seeing resistance. When we were applying for the NOAA grant, we needed to have letters. We had a dozen cities that said, yes, if you provide the funding, we'll do those amendments. So, you know, I think we've got the will there. I really do.
It goes back to the resources.
So, I mean, part of this conversation also stems from, I mean, you guys saw a couple bills last session around that suggested rulemaking, right, for Goal 7. And frankly, I have major concerns about a hazard-by-hazard approach to rulemaking. You know, the issues that Gold Beach is dealing with are not the issues that Madras is dealing with. And if you want to talk about wildfire as a single hazard, the issues are not the same. And so trying to get into rulemaking around specific hazards is a hornet's nest. What I think we could use is process that actually compels us to do what the goal is telling us to do. I mean, I when I go into a coastal community, I look at the comprehensive plan, I don't see the word tsunami in it. And many of our coastal community comprehensive plans, it's not in there. That's a concern to me. And that should be, that doesn't involve new data or anything like that. That involves, the resources and technical assistance and capacity to help those communities think through these tough questions. And it's going to be different. Newport's going to deal with the tsunami hazard much different than Seaside or Cannon Beach or you know, Port Orford or those kind of communities. And so, but until we actually sit down and have that conversation, my concern is we continue with the status quo, which is comprehensive plans on the coast in Oregon that don't have the word tsunami in them.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. Thank you, Chair Lively. Just a quick comment again to say thank you for what you're doing. And I could be wrong on the math. I'll expect Dave to correct me when I'm wrong. But right now, in terms of capacity, as I understand it, the state of Washington has twice the size in terms of personnel in their emergency management four times the size, even though they're twice our population. That I think that's right. Mm-hmm. That we basically have half the size in terms of capacity of what we would have if we were on the same track of investments that Washington has done. And what I ask you all to do, and something I know we have done privately and I suspect we will continue to do, during the last governor's tenure, emergency preparedness started to become a priority, but a lot of things that the previous governor put in place kind of just didn't continue along. It's time now to revisit these things. It's time, if we're going to be serious about this, to actually, number one, have an emergency management team at the state that can support the locals at the level they need, in addition to the coordination and the strategic planning. And in government, sometimes things are reduced to just, well, it's more money. This is not just about more money. It's about capacity in the right places mm-hmm. to empower the counties to do the things they need to make sure the state has the services available to support. And thank you for bringing this forward, but don't let us be your only audience. The governor's staff needs to hear this in broad strokes, and even as an interim director, sir, you have the ability to raise this flag, because at the end of the day, nobody wants to be the governor that could have done something more, or the legislature or the city manager could have done something more but didn't because we couldn't get past our own politics.
Chair Lively and Representative Evans, just wanted to channel the governor's office here a little bit. They did want us to bring up the fact that the last legislative session there was the resilience officer position created in the governor's office, and so we're hoping that that position and the funding that went with it will provide some of this kind of overall coordination that Josh has been talking about. So we have our fingers crossed on that. As I understand, they're hoping to fill that at the beginning of the year.
That's the hope.
Yes.
For the reason we agreed to it. Any other further questions? Thank you all for the information, the good work you're doing. Could you get all of that new information done in the next year?
I have 7 days left. So.
Okay. In 7 days?
So get right on it.
It's fascinating, though, isn't it, what the opportunity we have today to know, to be able to do that kind of stuff that when we started land use planning years ago, how nice that would have been if we'd known more of that then. I mean, when I go back to the comment made about in our urban growth boundaries, how much of that land is in the 100-year floodplain even.
100%.
You think about that and about what the provisions, I mean, it's just, we didn't have, you know, the FEMA maps weren't accurate. I mean, there's just all kinds of things. So we just need to do it. Huh? A little more resources, some more coordination. So, Will, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So that's all of our scheduled testimony. I have had a request for Mr. Stuckey to return.
Thank you for this.
I'm going to talk about this.
His matching shirts?
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah. We did not get the memo to wear green.
No, we didn't, did we?
Thanks to sensing a duck fan down there.
Yeah, Chair Lively, members of the committee, Dave Stuckey, Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department, and green today as an Army green officer. And with me today is
Andrew Phelps, Director of the Oregon Office of Emergency Management, in green.
In green, too. And we really appreciate that. So we should have all known.
Didn't get the memo.
Right. I believe that this was regarding a constituent out of Jackson County and Representative Esquivel.
Right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I requested that Dave and we get back and we talk about this, because this is something that every county overlooks. I mean, we have this great plan that we're going to do this, and we're going to clean up this, and we're going to do this, and it's our responsibility to take care of that after the fact. But I see no part of the education of the people on what they need to do. I see no effort on our part to get people, and if you read this, it was done by a fellow by the name of John Ivey, who's on on the on our emergency search and rescue. And he said, you know, we have to get people geared up because, you know, it's not, and I had a conversation with someone today, and the response was, I said, you know, we're about 60 years overdue with the earthquake, about that, something like that, a Cascadia. And the response was, well, yeah, but there's only a 20% chance it'll happen in the next few years. Well, that's one in five. What happens when it does? This is an educational process in order to allow people to go out and work with other people, and it's kind of like it's a cell system where you take 10 people, you take 10, 10, 10, 10, 10. Well, then they take 10, 10, 10, 10 and start educating people on what they need to do in order to survive, because we're not going to be able to do that in a lot of places. You take my area, and my area is going to be cut completely off between the east and the west. Because what do we have in the middle of Medford? An I-5 viaduct. And that baby's going to be flatter than a pancake when this thing hits. So, consequently, how are you going to get trucks in and out of my area? You're not going to do it. Bridges will be gone, possible. So we may be cut off from a period of anywhere from 30 days to on as much as a year to a year and a half. But people aren't prepared for it. You can talk and talk and talk, and you can ignore and ignore and ignore, and that's what people do. But I would like to see something like these plans implemented into our county plans. And by the way, we're far ahead of most people in this arena. The city of Medford has hired someone to take care of disaster. We're the only city, I think, in the state of Oregon that has that. And we're preparing for it. So I would like us to either have Mr. Ivey come up and give us a small presentation on this, because this is very good material.
Yes.
If you get a chance to read it, read it. But I would like some input from you, Dave.
Sir, Chair Lively, members of the committee, Representative Escobar, I think John Ivey has a lot of excellent points in this. There are, you know, the four pillars. Response is sexy. We run out there. We want to save lives. It's really easy to talk about response. Recovery is really, really hard after that incident. And quite frankly, getting your arms around it sometimes is a little bit difficult. Josh Bruce and that panel that was just up here was talking mitigation. Mitigation is getting that stuff done ahead of time. That's where that ounce of prevention is. And this preparedness is exactly the same thing as mitigation. If we can help prepare people today, then we can certainly mitigate that risk tomorrow. And it's just one of those things is where everyone has a choice to make. And you have a choice whether or not you want to be a victim tomorrow. Do you have your preparedness kit in your car? Do you have some? Do you have it at home? Is your family prepared? And if not, then okay. Likelihood, if we have a catastrophic, there's a greater potential that you're going to be a victim than if someone's prepared and has these items that Mr. Ivey in Jackson County has highlighted. So we his themes and his concepts I love. You know, we OEM has moved to the 2-week model. Versus 1 month or the 72 hours. We can debate how many it is all day long, but the concepts or constructs of how we do these things and how we get ready are really important, and we appreciate that. And I think Director Phelps had a few things he wanted to cover also.
Absolutely. Chair Lively, Representative Escobar. Community engagement is really at the heart of a successful emergency management program, whether it's the local level or the state level. I began my introduction to emergency management 5,181 days ago on September 11th, 2001, when I lived in Lower Manhattan and was directly impacted by the terrorist attacks. That led to my involvement in the Community Emergency Response Team, the establishment of the first Community Emergency Response Team in New York City. This has been a very successful program now across the country. There's a number of CERT teams across the state. City of Portland has established neighborhood emergency teams, which is a similar sort of a concept, and it's really neighbor helping neighbor, independent of the traditional first responders, firefighters and police and EMS workers. Cannon Beach is another great example of a community that's taken that initiative to prepare themselves and get that citizen involvement. They've established caches of emergency supplies where residents of Cannon Beach can essentially rent a 55-gallon drum all the way down to a 5-gallon bucket and store some water, food, medicine, pet supplies, things like that. So when they evacuate out of the tsunami inundation zone, they have access to their emergency supplies. So I think innovation is key. And anytime we can engage citizens in having these types of discussions and bringing these ideas to the policymakers and leadership of their communities or the state of Oregon, I think that's a good conversation to have. One of the hazards I don't think we talk about is the hazard of apathy. I think that's one thing that we always struggle against. Disasters are something that don't happen here. They happen someplace else. When we can have this discussion, I think we buy down that risk just a little bit. So certainly my office encourages at the local level communities become involved, become engaged. This past October, we conducted the Great Oregon Shakeout. We had 500,000 participants in that exercise. That was up from 390,000 the year prior, and each year it keeps building and building and building. I have to look at things like the New Yorker article and the comments that everything west of I-5 will be toast is sort of raising people's level of consciousness about the hazards that we face here in Oregon. And I was amazed to have conversations with folks who've lived here all their lives who didn't realize that that was a threat. It's perplexing, but I think it also provides a unique opportunity for us to engage in some of those conversations about the things that we can do to prevent Oregonians from being victims of a disaster and being survivors and part of that recovery process. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I've been here all my life, and I was completely unaware of what was going on until I got onto this committee.
Yeah.
That's exactly
great,
right.
Great discussion, sir.
Representative Evans.
Thank you, Chair Lively. In 2011, and again briefly in 2013, when Cameron Smith was the Senior Policy Advisor for Emergency Preparedness, we talked about realigning the Homeland Security Council because the language of Homeland Security often focuses on terror events as opposed to all hazards. And the original, or at least the Homeland Security Council that was stood up in 2008 under Governor Kongoski, was large, unwieldy, but it had pretty interesting conversations. And my concern, and I will continue to say this, is until we get that top-level strategic conversation as a routine, as a regular activity, we may fall victim to conversations about the coast in this way, or tsunamis in this way, or this program or that program. And one of the intents, though it didn't get perfected, but one of the intents of that program, when we tried to model it after what Utah had done with their Be Ready program, was the conversation between private sector, public sector leadership, that through time, whether people, the mass, were interested or not, certain organizations and certain leadership positions maintain at least a standardized level of engagement on key aspects and could project at least what the threats might be coming up and focus on coordination at that 30,000-foot level. I ask us to try and re-engage the governor's office on restarting that process and engaging it again, because I think it did do some good in the time that it was there.
And I think what this does, I mean, you take 4 million people. There's no way we can take care of 4 million people on a disaster. Just in my county alone, there's over 200,000. How do you have the infrastructure to take care of just that one pocket? So these people, the people in our counties and our neighbors, we have to rely upon ourselves first and foremost, because we're going to be the first line of defense, and we're going to be the people that will make the difference between what happens to people in the future. Because after things settle down, And I don't mean settle down, after the catastrophic event happens, then you have this period of shock, and then you have people that are going to make a run on the stores and all this stuff. And, you know, we need to be prepared to help each other, because we can either be part of the solution or part of the problem.
Sure. Thank you.
Very good. Well, we identified all the solutions, so... Maybe not quite all of the solutions, but we do know, I think we should be encouraged about the resources that are available, and it's a matter now how we marshal the resources and the information we have to do that. And one of the key challenges has been and will continue to be, whether they're human resources or financial resources, if we're serious about doing this, we've got to help make sure communities have the technical support and things they need to get through the rules that we've written in that. And the types of things that Josh Brushen University and other Dagami that offer are all wonderful things, but how we make sure people have access to those resources and can use them is still a huge problem. The good news is I think we have a lot more political will in the communities to understand this is serious. But again, the problem, we're way behind the curve from a standpoint of now trying to react to it and how we do it.
Catch you.
It's going to be an interesting journey, but I'll look forward to, we'll have more conversations, look forward to not 16, but in 17, hopefully we can look at some things we can do that make this easier. We need to talk a minute about our bills, potential bills, committee bills, which we have a large number, three.
Large number, three. Is that a big three?
No, it's a little three. So, Cheyenne, do you want to just let us know kind of what's on the table?
Sure, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Representative Esquivel is correct. The committee has three bills, and one has been, a request has been filed, but we don't have a concept returned yet, and that's dealing with job interviews for veterans, and Representative Lively and Huffman have worked on that. It's a little premature to talk about that till we get a draft back for the members and the stakeholders to look at, but the request has been made, so that bill's been used. There are two that remain.
Can you repeat? I didn't hear what you
There are three committee bills available. One has been used, and it's the job interviews.
Is that
Oh, thank you. Okay. Yeah, just didn't hear that part.
It's Bill 87 from last session, if that's your reference point. We don't yet have a concept.
Representative Evans and Huffman have been working with the stakeholders to try to...
So picking up where it left off from the 2015
Perfect.
Session. Representative Boone, who wasn't here today, has also asked to use a committee bill to redraft Senate Bill 808 or the amended replaced version of 808. I wasn't sure which. This is one of the bills from last session that didn't go through that established a task force on mass sheltering. Okay. And it was one of the recommendations of the implementation task force from Senate Bill 33. And there is some discussion with her and OSPAC folks about the handful of bills that didn't pass that Senate Bill 33 task force folks recommended, and the relative merits, the pros and cons of going forward, burning a short session bill, and this is what the chair and the members will be talking about, and Representative Boone and leadership, the merits of burning a short session bill when the governor's office, as Ms. Snow pointed out, is due to fill the vacancies
fill
that the office of the governor is going to appoint a state resilience officer should, effective January 2016, and that was from House Bill 2207 from last session. So that is on the horizon. The person who's supposed to do some of that centralizing and prioritizing is on the horizon. Did you want to burn a bill to do that, to redraft failed bills from 2015? And then Representative Evans also had a request he has pitched to the chair, and that maybe for using a committee bill, and I don't know where you are in your process, if you want to discuss it further at
your detail or not.
Sure,
your concept.
Context takes about 2 minutes. So during last session, for those that are just tuning in, we had an idea basically having to do with resilience, funding for resilience, prioritized statewide purchases of equipment that could, in similar fashion to how UASC used to put assets around the region, pre-deploy specific types of equipment, generators, trucks, vans, that could be used before there's a disaster by nonprofits or by others, but during times of disaster could be shifted around and would be turnkey. Instead of having to get them somewhere, they would be there. And part of the agreement of the long-term lease would be that they'd be in good maintenance and that they could be provided to wherever they need to be sent to when it's time. In talking with the treasurer's office during the interim, it was identified that of the money through Article Q bonds that is available for bonding, that not all of it's going to be used because there's not enough shovel-ready programs. There might be as much as $12 or $15 million available for this. And the idea would be for a bill that would actually allow spending out of this biennium's bonding authority. And the name of it is kind of Lend-Lease, to purposefully go back to the idea of World War II, where Roosevelt was sending destroyers to help out folks. They were leased to the Britons. They weren't given or they weren't sold. The idea in this case is that we would come up with prioritized areas where we have specific needs,
we would have the state, through the use of state purchase power, buy X number of equipment that had been identified by certified smart people that recognize what they need, and they would be offered as a grant over a 10 or 15 year period. And the idea would be that at the end of that 10 or 15 year period, the person who's been maintaining it would have an option to buy it for a very little amount, but they would have sweat equity into it. It's a way to pre-deploy assets so we know for a fact that we have interoperable equipment, stuff that we would have had a say, so it's not a generator that doesn't use a particular type of part in this case where it does others. And the other added advantage of this program would be that, at least theoretically, we could go through DRMO and purchase some of the generators and some of the equipment that is coming back from Iraq, and at least in the non-military side, but the support logistics side, could be available for pennies on the dollar and pre-deploy it into areas where we know we're going to have need. And to hopefully start a way over the long term to, in small amounts, in targeted areas, with partners, pre-deploy an immense amount of material so that when the event occurs, we don't have to worry about getting things to the response area. That's the plan.
So let me get this straight. You want to allow someone to have this as a backup generator or something like that? Is that it?
Not just backup. I'll give you how the UASC system worked. The federal system, after 9/11, one of the many programs, and I'm trying to figure out what UASC is called now and who does it, but for a while, Urban Area Security Initiative would provide certain types of assets in urban areas. So in the Portland area, Clark County was a part of it, and four counties in Oregon. And they may purchase a boat, they may purchase a generator. The idea is, especially in areas like small towns, small communities that don't have the ability to buy their own rescue boat, that don't necessarily have the ability to buy an extra generator, folks that in their capital budgets will never be able to afford the things that the state would benefit from them having during a disaster, that they could actually put in for a grant, a lease, of these different types of equipment that have been identified. And they would maintain them, they would operate them. For all intents and purposes, they would act like they're theirs, but during times of critical need, they could be shifted around.
Sure, I understand that part.
So that's the
now,
plan.
Now, what would something like that cost? Do you have any idea?
Well, the model actually would be, and again, I don't want to start a fight on this, but
let's record this. We want to make sure he gets his number right.
The original Oregon Health Plan, the original Oregon Health Plan, where certified smart people got together and said there's a list of X number of procedures, mm-hmm. and then based on the budget, you decide how much you can buy down to. Mm-hmm. So the theory would be, once it's up and running, so again, the first one would be a pilot project to use the money that's currently in this bonding. If it was continued, theoretically, the Homeland Security Council and others would set a list of types of equipment that are basically prioritized, and we would buy X number of generators, Y number of vans, mm-hmm. Z number of whatever, that's, again, that list, and then interested parties, and again, I would argue that it could be public agencies as well as nonprofits, because some of the nonprofits have ESF requirements for population and agriculture and other things, that if there's an entity out there that would basically sign away that they'd keep it in good condition and maintain it, and it's in the area we need it, and they would commit to moving it to where it needed to be staged during a time of disaster, the state wins by having that turnkey capability already fielded, instead of having to requisition and try to hope that the feds can send us stuff.
Instead of trying to do it all at once.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That'd be interesting to look into that.
So that's the idea for the bill.
The idea of what he suggested, so.
Well, that was your idea, wasn't it, Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
It was the chair's idea, yes.
Yeah. So the process will be, so we've got these ideas and talked about it, so I'll talk with leadership, because part of the issue with the short session is going to see where other people may be pulling from the same direction, trying to use the same funds or something. So we'll put together the concepts and talk to leadership and see what might have some support outside of this committee, because it doesn't do us a lot of good, especially
well,
in the short
we also,
session.
We can put that on the radar scope for 17.
Right.
Absolutely.
That's the one we really need to do.
Yeah, we'd want to make sure we did that. If we don't actually, but even if we introduce the bill, we may introduce the bill just to start the conversation recognizing that. And I don't have a problem using one of our three bills to do that if there's bills.
Well, you could also, if you had to, we could amend it to take place in 2017.
Right. And Mr. Chair, if I could, I was actually going to wait till 2017 to introduce the bill. The Treasurer's Office actually approached me.
Well, see, and that's why we need to.
And they said, look, on this Article Q thing, if you remember during the session, Treasury came in and we talked about how to make some of those mechanics work. Mm-hmm. Laura called me up and said, you know, if you want to do this as a pilot program, just to see if it works, there may be some money and the Article Q definitions fit it. So
probably the reason we've had the conversation, just since we're not always in that position. So, I mean, Treasury say we have money.
Yeah.
Good idea.
So we'll let you know where we're at when we have those conversations.
We want people to know, though, if it's not successful, it's Representative Evans' idea. If it's successful, it's the rest of our ideas.
That's the rest of ours.
Right.
It was good work by the committee.
Representative Evans.
Understood.
Okay. Anything else? 3 days down. Then we get to rest, don't we?
Right. No.
We don't get to rest.
No, Mr. Chair.
No, we don't. But thank you all for spending your Wednesday afternoon here.
Thank you.
We'll see you all again.
You going to adjourn us, Mr. Chair?
No, I'm just going to sit here.
You're going to sit here?
Get some more time.
Well, that's okay. We'll go home and watch
on
TV.
I was waiting for all you just to get up and leave before I hit the gavel.
Well, you got it.
Okay.
Well, you got it.
Okay. Before I hit the